the most horrible place in hell is being devoured by Satan, based on Dante's Inferno.
Right, the ninth circle.
Yeah, the last one is just, and there's one specific person. Actually, there are three, but the only name that I remember is Judas. He's being eaten by Satan.
Yeah, what a bad deal too, because Jesus couldn't have fulfilled his role as the savior without Judas. So I feel like Judas yeah. really gets fucked in this story. It doesn't feel fair to me that his betrayal is needed.
Hello, everyone. Episode 3 of Brushes and Keys. This is Angela Bermudez.
And Austin Wintry.
And Austin Wintry, just in case.
Well, yeah, I'm used to being the only Austin, so I...
But not anymore.
Elon Musk tweeted yesterday, make Austin weirder.
Yeah.
And I found myself thinking, I bet... Because he has like 100 million followers or whatever. I said, I bet there's a lot of people who
are
the same as me.
Yes.
How many other Austins? Yeah, I did not investigate, but I bet I'm far from the only. I bet every Austin in the world took advantage of that moment.
By doing that, they're not being weird. They're being normal.
It's true,
normal.
Being all very conformist.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a fair point.
Yeah. Anyway, talking about a big amount of Austins all over the place. The topic of today.
What a cruel transition. Go ahead, finish.
We are going to talk about hell. How about that?
Yes, indeed. What is your definition of hell?
I guess the common knowledge of hell. I just learned that hell is a pit of fire.
This is how you were raised to,
yes,
in other words.
Yes, like, I believe, yeah, I was raised that
did
hell
you learn
was
that.
That
because that was just what people said? Or do you have specific memories of being like in church and it being described that way by a preacher?
It's, I guess, very mixed. You go to school and they have religion as a...
Like a class you took was about religion?
Yeah. Yeah.
Meaning, like, it's about the religion. It's not like Sunday school where we're doing Bible study, that kind of thing.
It's exactly that.
Okay, so it's religious training. It's not like, today we're going to study Hinduism.
Oh, no,
study,
not at all.
Like,
no.
It's religion all, class.
Yeah, well, you know, Costa Rica is known, the religion that is more prominent, it's Catholicism. And that is what you learn. Well, obviously, I don't know, it's been... decades since I
but is it normal school like in public school?
Yes, public school.
They have Catholic
mm-hmm. they have Catholic
class,
yes, and you learn all this stuff. You learn,
were there any kids in the class that you remember that were not Catholic, that
like they
were
white weird
to, like, fake
kids
it?
In The Simpsons that they asked to get out of the classroom,
the like Quaker kids or whatever, yeah, like Jeremiah and Ezekiel or whatever, yeah, exactly. I was curious if there was like a random Jew or something.
There
was
random people.
Like...
I never asked what was their religion, just, you know, Christian or whatever. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But there were random kids that they just, you know, they were asked to just be quiet or sleep or go out or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Sleep.
Yeah, they normally do that. Used to do that. You just sleep on your desk. Just don't pay attention or whatever you want to do.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that that kind of thing ever happened. I don't remember ever seeing a teacher go, just sleep.
Like, yeah, well, what are you going to do? I guess depending on the teacher, they're just going to ask the kid to be quiet, and then what's he going to do?
Of course, I don't... Yeah, and there's no real equivalent to this sort of thing in a public education setting in the U.S. because there wouldn't be a subject. I mean, I guess maybe like in the case of that Simpsons, like maybe a sex ed class or something where a parent specifically said, I don't want my kid in that class. Like that is probably pretty common, but they certainly don't have anything that's the equivalent of like Sunday school.
Do you remember the Superintendent Chalmers being like so mad at Flanders when he was a...
Yeah, prayer in school.
Uh-huh. So I believe that that's what happens in the U.S. Like, they don't let religion to be part of the school?
Strictly speaking, it's not legal. Oh. Because in public schools, because public schools are paid for by taxpayer dollars, they are therefore an extension of the government. And the U.S. has a very strict rule that the government cannot restrict or endorse any specific religion. So there cannot be an official religion. You can't be like, oh, we're a Christian school, but also a public school. Nor can they say, your Christianity is forbidden at this school. Like, the government is basically supposed to just keep its mouth shut no matter what. There's the famous expression of Thomas Jefferson writing the letter to the Quakers, I believe, of Danbury, Connecticut, saying that there will be forever a wall built between the church and the state. And that's the Christopher Hitchens line, Mr. Jefferson, please build up that wall, which is a wonderful little play off of the Ronald Reagan, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall from the height of the Cold War. In any case, I always just loved that quote of Mr. Jefferson, please build up that wall. Point being, yes, there would be no, there are, I remember when I was in school, I went to all public schools, and there were, students could form clubs.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, there could be a Bible study group of students that organize themselves, and they can do it at the school. It's not like religion is forbidden at the school. You could wear a cross necklace if you wanted, or a Jewish star, and some of the teachers would as well. That some of the teachers, most of the teachers were religious, and would wear, you know, like a cross necklace or whatever. So it's not like it's illegal. It's just the school can't do anything official,
right?
And there probably were classes like comparative religion classes where it's like, okay, this semester we're gonna spend a month learning about Christianity. We're gonna spend a month learning about Islam. Like, there probably were classes like that. I don't think I ever took one. I wish I had. That probably would have been really fascinating.
Yeah.
But I ask because the result is that for me, and probably a lot of Americans who are not raised in religious homes, the knowledge of what hell is essentially entirely from pop culture as a kid.
I was going to ask you, what is your depiction of hell when you were a kid?
I had a very cartoony sense of what hell would be because that was where I saw it. You know, it's like you see The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Or you see, like, even scary movies or something. Mm-hmm. Like, you remember, I wasn't really a kid anymore, but like Event Horizon, we watched not that long ago, where it's like a spaceship that travels accidentally through hell.
That's actually that's very scary to me.
Yeah, and but it's that very traditional, you know, fire, mm-hmm. demons, torture, blood, like skeletons on the walls,
right?
That kind of thing, like mm-hmm. baked into the ground. I think probably one of the best pop culture representations ever is the early episodes of South Park.
Of course, we're going to bring up South Park.
You know what I just love so much, where it's like orientation, all the new souls arriving in hell, and it's like the welcoming meeting where there's like the guy at the clipboard, you know, getting the names of the new recruits. And all these people are like, I don't understand. I was a good person. You know, like, I donated my money to the poor and I did charity and this. And the one person's like, I was a preacher. I never did anything wrong. I spoke the gospel. I spread the word of God. And he's like, sorry, everyone. Turns out the right choice was Mormons.
Yeah, I remember.
And they're all like, damn it. And
I remember. So genius.
And I love the ultimate payoff in that episode with Saddam Hussein, of course, is sent to hell, and he gets into a relationship with Satan, and then he becomes like this horrible boyfriend, and Satan hates him. So he realizes he keeps killing him, but what does that do? It just basically resets him showing back up in hell. So Satan makes a deal with God to give Saddam Hussein the ultimate punishment, which is to be alone in heaven surrounded by Mormons.
Oh my God.
And it's one of the most hilarious and kind of ballsy things South Park ever did, but it's truly hilarious. In any case, so yeah, I never thought about what hell could mean until, like, to me it was just also, as a non-religious person, it struck me as just so obviously. It seemed silly. It never felt scary. It
never. Felt like not even when you were a kid. You never were scared of going to a place of suffering if you do something wrong.
No, because it was I never entertained the idea that that could be real. It never seemed possible that it could be real. It seemed like this is a story people tell. It felt no different than if you told me about Zeus and Thor and
I understand, because I was the same with Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if you think it's cool, or even if you're like, oh, that's fun or whatever.
Right.
Like, to me, hell thought, I found myself the poetic use of hell, like in music or in theater or in movies, that was interesting to me. Like,
yeah.
It made it emotionally compelling, like in the terms of a story. You know, like if someone is rescued from hell, you know, like,
mm-hmm,
like,
the, mm-hmm.
like there's great, there's a lot of great in Buffy. They play with this a lot. Really
oh
well.
My God. Yes.
Like there's a lot of interesting like places. And one of the most genius things they ever did on Buffy, this is a spoiler.
Oh,
is where they pull her out of hell, and they think she sacrifices herself and is condemned to hell. But she comes back all emotionally dead, and she's like totally detached.
No.
And they think, what's wrong with you? We saved you. And she finally reveals to them, you didn't pull me out of hell, you pulled me out of heaven, and like I sacrificed myself and that was my reward, and now here I am again. And when you've been in heaven, earth feels like hell.
You know, there are some
mind-blowing
religions, there are some religions that actually think that we are actually living in hell. And then, you know, we're going to be judged and see what happens after that. And then there's the reincarnation, which I guess is just falling again.
Well, my understanding of the Hindu concept of reincarnation is that basically if you live a good life, you come back like in a better sort of situation. You know, like it takes many lives. In each one doing better than the last one, and sort of better karma in a way. And eventually you can kind of transcend and reach nirvana, you know, but the thing that's always struck me as truly evil about that belief, about the whole notion of karma, is that it always means that if something bad happens to you, you deserve it. That's the definition of karma. It's like, you know, everyone focuses on the, oh, well, you know, I'm doing a good deed and, you know, maybe that means something good will come my way eventually or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Which also kind of means,
yeah, it's,
you know,
a very,
the only reason you're doing the good deed?
Exactly, yeah. It's like the episode of Friends with Phoebe and Joey fighting for the good deeds.
100%.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like...
There's no good deed.
Well, and that's where I think having a kind of, you know, slightly sort of libertarian view of human free will and human behavior, like how we're motivated. It's okay to say people, there's nothing evil about being motivated by self-interest, because you can actually, if it makes you feel good to do good for somebody and that's why you do it, the greed of you wanting to feel good is still making the world a better place. What's wrong with that? Like, I don't see any issue with that.
I just had a flashback of the, when Flanders, they put the TV on and there's this show with two sheep.
What I love about that is where he's like, he goes, like, my brother or whatever has a sin to confess. I wish I had a sin to confess.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, you do, the sin of envy. And they're all like, yay. Yeah, that's so fun. That's the kind of stuff
God.
That as a kid, my dad would laugh
uh-huh.
hard, because there was nothing like that on TV. Like, that was super, especially as an animation, so, so bold.
And, oh, my God.
And
yeah.
risky.
It's
and,
so good.
And I remember my dad would laugh at that stuff. And only as an adult rewatching those did I realize just how
yes, I
hilarious
know.
That idea is of like this moral of the story celebration.
Honestly, I think it wasn't that bad back then, because there are so many things that are bad today that weren't, you know, before. I think that today there's no tolerance for a lot of stuff, obviously. So back then, by saying it was ballsy, I don't think so. It was just genius.
No, I stand by that. I get what you're saying. I think the things that we're not allowed to talk about and the things that are considered off limits have changed. But like, especially for an animated show, this was not normal. Not on a mainstream TV network and stuff.
Yeah, but if we if we go way back and watch, I don't know, one of those like very old Warner Brothers cartoons, that's crazy. Or even you know, Tom and Jerry, again, there's a lot of stuff there that is actually not playable today.
Well, that may be true. I mean, but in some cases it's just things like there are definitely some things we go back and you watch like an old cartoon and you're like, that's pretty racist.
Yep.
Like where I'm not a fan of, therefore we should bury it and censor it and it shouldn't be visible, but I can appreciate that it's awkward and you
of
go
course,
well
yeah. it gets weird. Yes.
I don't know that we should just straight-facedly also go it's fine. Like I think you do end up, you know, I'm never in a pro censorship crowd, but I can acknowledge like, yeah, there are things.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of sex and dark humor and racism.
In any case, but on the idea of hell, the thing that like the classical composers, particularly those that it's not really a hell, but the Requiem Mass is a thing a lot of composers have taken the time to write. Like it's kind of a thing. It's sort of like classical composers, you know, felt this challenge to everybody should try to write a symphony, or mm-hmm. everyone should try to write a opera, or everyone should write a violin concerto. Like there's certain things that classical composers felt a certain pressure to always try. And Requiem Mass became one of those. There's a handful. Fauré wrote one. Of course, Mozart very famously died while writing his, so he kind of wrote his own mass in a way. One of the greatest ever is the Italian operatic composer, who was an atheist, wrote an amazing Requiem Mass, and they always have this section in it called the Dies Irae, which is the Day of Wrath, which is sort of about the Day of Judgment, which is not exactly hell, but it's presumably related. And so it became a very appealing thing for composers, because then you have, like, how do I depict sort of this apocalyptic day of God's judgment on humanity, where, you know, all the sinners are cleansed and sent to hell and whatever. And so Mozart's is really powerful and aggressive, but Verdi's, my God, it's truly one of the most amazing pieces of music. And it's hilarious to think he didn't believe it remotely. He didn't think Mozart arguably did, you know, and he depict hell from a much more genuine, yeah. You know, I believe Mozart was fairly religious, not religious in the way that some of the other...
It's just the inspiration. Inspiration can take you places.
Yeah, and I think Verdi's, when, like, we've talked about paintings that depict hell, and I think the Verdi Requiem is probably the closest that has that very traditional, where you just think this really does seem to be... It's to me, it's incredible. But it's funny how, as an adult, my concept... If I were a believer, I feel like the notions of hell that make more sense to me are a lot more sort of postmodern, like the idea that
if you were talking about a painting in specific, I can't find it. Maybe I'm not typing.
No, I wasn't. I was saying.
I see.
When we talk about like those famous paintings, the piece of music that feels closest to them to me is the Verdi Dies Irae from his Requiem. Like the famous, what's the one, the famous of like eating the head?
That's
who's the artist again?
Goya. I can't remember his first name. Francisco.
Yeah. What's that?
Saturn called again? Eating his son.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, like those kinds of very sort of, I guess that's not really a depiction of hell either then, but it still feels...
Oh, yeah, it's pretty much...
it feels like a compatible, at least, with our belief of hell.
Yeah. And that actually reminds me the, like, the lowest, the most horrible place in hell is being devoured by Satan, based on Dante's Inferno.
Right, the ninth circle.
Yeah, the last one is just... And there's one specific person. Actually, there are three, but the only name that I remember is Judas. He's being eaten by Satan.
Yeah, what a bad deal, too, because Jesus couldn't have fulfilled his role as the savior without Judas. So I feel like Judas yeah. really gets fucked in this story. It doesn't feel fair to me that his betrayal is needed. In any case, I want to know your to me, that Verdi Requiem as a classical portrayal of hell.
You're making me choose because you chose a...
No, I'm just curious if there's a painting that you feel like, if somebody said, I've never heard the word hell, and you were like, I want to show you one painting.
Well, it's not that I know all the paintings,
nor I with music.
Among the ones I know, the first one that comes to mind is, and I think he's always going to be, Bosch's The Garden of Earthly Delights.
Ah, right.
Hieronymus Bosch.
Yep. What about that feels so spot on for you, out of curiosity?
Because there's a lot of demons doing a lot of just making a lot of people suffer in a whole different ways, and it's very funny, and it's pretty interesting. It's not that I think that is the most accurate, but if you ask me what painting comes to mind, that one, because it's so very unique, and there's no other painting like it. I think Bosch's took 20 years to make that painting.
Meaning all the different sections of it? Or just the hell part?
No, the whole thing. And it was like a commission forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think it was a commission. Somebody that was getting married or something asked for a commission, and that was a painting he did.
I just pulled it up on Wikipedia to see. Commissioned between 1490 and 1510. I didn't realize it was that old. I didn't remember that those were the years he lived.
How much is that? 600 years?
510 years ago, give or take.
You know, there's one part that I think you will enjoy. There's like a little weird demon with a frog face, pink frog face, pointing to a butt that has music notes, that has like a tattoo made of sheet music. Can you find it?
No, I don't see it.
Well, I found on YouTube the sound of that. Let me first show you. Right now, there's a lot of people that took that sheet music and they made a lot of interpretations. There's piano, there's choir, there's orchestra, there's so many things. Here's the butt with the sheet music. And this is how it sounds.
Butt song from hell. It doesn't sound particularly menacing.
I don't know if he knew how to write music, or if it was just random notes. Honestly, I don't know the backstory of
it. Also, it's worth pointing out that the modern, in the 1500s, the modern musical notation didn't exist. So they're like scholars, Renaissance and medieval musical notation has certain little fragments of subjectivity to how you determine what notes are what. Like, you have to kind of analyze it based on, you know, the exact time period, the region. There wasn't a standard like we have
now.
Oh,
wow.
So there, like, I bet you if you research this further, there's disagreement about what those notes could be. Because, for example, even just looking at it, there's no clef. So you don't know, yeah. Is this a treble clef, an alto clef, a tenor clef?
I figure it was a very old-fashioned, in quotes, way to write music, because it's not even a five-line sheet. It has just, like, you know, three lines, four lines.
Yeah, so part of that is probably that he didn't know what he was doing as an artist, and or... like he didn't know what was technically correct, and right. or it could also be that there was just conventions of the time that are just have changed since then. You know, people sheet music for the majority of human history, there was no sheet music of anywhere. You know, like I remember when starting on the Banner Saga, and I wanted to research Viking music. You know, there's no sheet music. No one has any clue, like what a Viking song sounded like. Even though they have found musical instruments and they found evidence that the Vikings had music like every other culture has had music.
Mm-hmm.
But because there was no standard notation. A lot of arts have had this problem. You know, there have been dance and ballet for mm-hmm. thousands of years, but there's still to this day not really a ballet equivalent of sheet music. So there's like people would read about a dancer, but they can't recreate the movements. They don't really know what they did, how it looked. And it's always been an interesting challenge about, like, painting has always had one of the biggest advantages in terms yes. of the record is the art itself, mm-hmm. not just what people thought about it.
Yeah.
The way it is with music. You know, you can read ancient Greeks describing music they hear, but there's no sheet music notation from back then.
Unless you're a drunken guy that saw a bear and went and described it to an artist.
Exactly. Yeah, there's that problem, but at least there's something.
Yeah, there's something.
But yeah, what I was going to say a minute ago is that funny enough, the most intellectually satisfying version of hell to me now
mm-hmm.
is what modern Christians refer to as what's called annihilation theory, which is the idea that hell is not a place you go. Hell is being separate from God.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. I read about it.
And so it's basically suggestive that there maybe isn't actually a hell as we would define it. There's heaven, there's life on earth, and then if you are condemned to hell, your soul is erased out of existence.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and you are for the first time separate from God. And so for me, when I think of, like, how would I portray, if someone were to hire me to say, we want you to portray hell, like in pure music, not as a film score or video game score that takes place in hell, but just like write music about hell. I almost feel like I don't know what I would do other than maybe go in some kind of John Cagey direction of like, it's silence, you know, it's some self-reflective, like ask every member of the audience to record themselves talking into their phone and then broadcast all of that simultaneously back at them. So everyone is forced to hear this chaos of their own voices something. Like, you know what I mean? Like something that stretches beyond F sharps and E flats and D major chords. Like those tools feel too primitive in a way. Hell feels like it's a higher concept in a way to me these days, if I were to believe in it, which of course I don't.
How about I read to you a few definitions of hell from different religions, and then you pick the one you like to go. How about that?
Okay, there you go. Picking my least objectionable hell. This is an interesting game. I did not see this coming. Okay, hit me.
Let's start with the normal, the one that we all know, I believe, Christianity. Actually, there are like two versions. The regular one with the fire, the scalding water, snakes, and the other that Dante portrayed on his poem.
Mm. So, yes, the Divine Comedy.
Yeah. The do you need to say...
Well, I was just going to add as a point about like Christian doctrine, my understanding is that a lot of that whole eternal torture and most of that's not actually really in the Bible. Like, there is mention of the lake of fire, but there's actually very little talk of hell in the Bible compared to our modern, the modern Christian understanding of it. Most of that's been added by preachers over the last 2,000 years. That's my understanding.
Even though I should know more about this stuff, I don't. So...
Yeah, it's just one of those interesting pieces of trivia.
I will read you some of the notes that I have. Like, I found an article with different versions of hell. Okay, the regular Christianity with the snakes and the fire, there's no way out of the Christian hell. Once you're drowning in a lake of fire, that's it. There's no way to repent your sins and no chance of earning a way to limbo, and especially not to heaven. Theologians have stated the worst part of hell is being separated from God for eternity. That's the one you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And the other version, which is the Dante, is the underworld is a multi-layer kingdom full of different punishments for different offenses. I think mm-hmm. I like the organization of this one.
Oh, that's too funny.
This hell has...
It's so interesting, though, how it seems like it doesn't... Doesn't it negate the idea of it being hell if there's any aspect of it that's appealing? Like, isn't it supposed to be the worst conceivable? There's just nothing positive about it. So it's like, in a way, that hell couldn't exist in your
maybe
world. Because you're like, yeah, you know, I appreciate that this is nicely organized. And it's like, so it's like for you to go there, they would have to like... make it messy and chaotic just to make it that much worse for you.
Oh, so you think that maybe that depends on each soul, I guess. Each soul has its own hell. I would like to think that.
Yeah, but,
continue.
Okay, either way, yeah, yep.
Yeah, this hell has everything from a limbo for pagans and the unbaptized, that's essentially a lesser heaven, to an area where heretics. To an area where
Heretics.
To an area where heretics have to enter.
What is the Spanish word for heretic?
Hereje.
Hereje.
Uh-huh.
Oh, herejos.
Have to enter themselves in flaming grave plots. This is one of the more iconic hells. And the worst part... There's a level in Dante's Inferno for every kind of sin. As the further down one travels, the worse things get. For instance, the deepest circle of hell is reserved for the sin of treachery. This is where sinners like Cain are trapped in ice. The very worst punishment is reserved for the three greatest betrayers in history. There you go. Judas Iscariot and the Romans Brutus and Cassius. I don't know who those are. The three are...
Those who betrayed Caesar?
Maybe.
when did Dante write this?
Oh, I don't know.
Brutus, one of the most famous lines in all literature and history is at the moment of Caesar being surrounded and stabbed to death, realizing that Brutus was... among those betraying him, and he says, "Et tu, Brutus," meaning "and you, Brutus," like of all them, I saw it coming, but you also, like one of the great, like if someone betrays you who you expect it to, but then someone who you would not have expected. That's a phrase you hear all the time.
Yeah,
I didn't remember though that Dante felt that that was on par with the betrayal of Jesus. Feels a little...
That's not a very...
arguably,
reliable.
Brutus is worse than Judas. Because, again, Jesus' death had to happen for the salvation of mankind.
I guess. Anyway, the three are endlessly chewed upon by the three jaws of Lucifer. Lucifer has three heads.
That I did not know. All right, give me some more hellscapes.
There you go. So, for the Wiccans, some believers feel that heaven and hell are what you make of it, but others believe in the concept of a Christian hell, where there's a fiery pit waiting for Wiccans who slip up and break the laws of their religion. The worst part is probably, you know, there's nothing worse for a follower of a pagan religion than win up in the hell of a mainstream monotheistic religion.
That's funny. That's so, like, hipster. That, like, I'm a Wiccan, I'm cool, I'm outside of Christianity, and the worst punishment would be to be part of Christian hell.
Yeah.
That's, I've never heard that before. That strikes me as hilarious.
All the things that I've seen, most of it is pretty funny. It's just, you know, the irony.
Right.
Ancient Egyptians, whether you're good or evil, getting through the underworld in ancient Egypt is a nightmare. Even if you're going to heaven, you still have to fight your way through the demons that wait at the gates. If you're sent to hell, you're stuck in a world of pain and misery. That sounds like the episode we watch on Love Their Robots when they were crossing this cave and there was like a giant
Cthulhu giant.
Right, Souls in this ancient Egyptian hell are whipped into non-existence, but not before they experience a gauntlet of agony. In this religion, a soul still means a body, so the deceased can have their organs torn out and their own refuse shoved in their mouths. In some instances, evildoers are put into ovens. They are squeezed dry by Sheshmu, the god of the wine, and forced to drown in their own blood.
Yeah, what's always interesting to me about these kinds of, like, ancient Egypt or the ancient Greeks or the Romans, like, a lot of the concepts of the underworld are very much like it's a place and there's souls there, and it's also kind of like a process of passing through it, and there might even be a way out of it. And it's only later, the later monotheistic, like Christian and Islam, that have a far more all-encompassing, like, God is everywhere. God's not a person, the way Thor is essentially like a Superman and not really a person. And God is like this entity that exists outside of the universe. It's like religion sort of got more and more abstract with the notion of God, but also, of course, of heaven and hell. And so that it becomes less of a place and more of a state or even a non-state, which is why I think all the classical and ancient portrayals are way more interesting. even if they're maybe not intellectually as interesting, but they're more, the imagery is more interesting and more poetic and colorful and evocative, you know. Like I said, I can write a piece of music about like a ancient Egypt. Everything you just said about, you know, being whipped out of existence sounds like something you could really write an interesting piece of music about.
Yeah.
But the idea of non-existence, I'm like, wouldn't silence then be the only kind of accurate portrayal?
Who knows?
Yeah, I...
Do you want to experience it?
Silence? I'm definitely not that familiar with silence. It is endlessly interesting to me how this has always been such a motivator for artists.
Oh, yeah.
You know, these kinds of... It always makes me wonder... If you genuinely think this is real, it would almost feel like you're holding a loaded gun. You know, it's like, should I even be painting this? You know what I mean? It feels like if you really, truly believe it, it would feel almost risky.
Who knows? I guess it's a maturity thing. If you even believe that there is hell, but you're fine with yourself and your soul, you have nothing to fear, you know? But if you're...
I suppose that's true.
By saying maturity, I mean, like, if you're like a kid, you know, like, you might be scared the shit out of it because, you know, kids are just easy. I don't know how to explain, but even if they don't
you're saying it perfectly.
Even if they don't do wrong, they can be very scared by that concept.
Yeah, it's part of why I think that kind of religious upbringing can be actually quite traumatizing for a kid. And there are some people, I don't think I agree with the fullest extent of this, but there are definitely some people that think that that level of religious education for a kid is bordering on child abuse because they
I guess it goes all the way, you know. There's different situations. You can't just generalize a whole religion.
Of course not. No. It would be specific instances. Yes. Because there are, I've watched interviews with people who are atheists in their 50s that still wake up with nightmares.
Yeah.
From the images of hell they got as a child.
Like the Carrie mom type?
Yeah. Yeah, like who threaten them basically, yeah. And say, you know, mm-hmm. which those cases are very obviously, that's like parent child abuse, that they're using the religion,
yeah.
But it's still the parent or the preacher or whoever gave kid that idea.
Honestly, I wouldn't blame them. I think that there's probably like a fear of not knowing how to raise them, and so they go to that road.
That's probably true.
There's so
that's
many.
It's a very empathetic way to look at it, but you're probably right.
Yeah, I believe there's a lot of those cases, you know. Also the ignorance. You just don't know anything else but that.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out that I have plenty of friends and family who are deeply religious who never taught it like that.
Yeah.
You know, who never saw it as a way to kind of make their kids or make the parish straighten up and fly right, as they say, by, you know, making them afraid of the consequences. It's certainly the very Jewish perspective is do the right thing because it's right, not because you're afraid of the consequences of doing what's wrong.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Because
Judaism doesn't really have a hell.
I remember when I was younger, at some point I did something wrong, you know, like I stole, I don't know, like candy or whatever. And I remember thinking, well, I did it, so I guess I'm going to hell. I can't do it again.
Yeah, you're past the threshold, and now you're like, I may as well have fun.
Exactly.
That's so funny.
As a kid, you just don't know, right? You just, you know, you try to be careful. You try to not watch that movie or to not listen to that music because, you know, it gets into your brain, and then Satan comes for you and all that stuff.
That's a good segue. My album recommendation for this one, in that spirit, probably the most awesome portrayal of hell in modern times imaginable, is I couldn't resist recommending Mick Gordon's 2016 Doom.
Are we jumping?
Soundtrack. Well, it's just so you said don't listen to that piece of music.
Yeah.
I am sure there are some fundamentalist evangelical types that Mick Gordon's Doom is strictly forbidden in that household.
But there's no words in that score. It's just music, isn't it?
It's just raw metal.
Yeah.
But it's some of the most incredible modern metal.
It is, yes, very busy and loud and goes, like, you hear screaming or whatever, but also it lets the brain rest a few times. It's not like all madness all the time. There are music that is just like that, and it's just insane. I think his music is more listenable for someone like me because it has like breaks, you know, it has like ups and downs, and it's not all the time banging.
Yeah. I mean, I would call that musical. Like, to me, to be musical means it breathes. When things are more mechanical, they don't feel musical. Like, anybody can just make a thing that's just a nonstop sound, a nonstop onslaught, but to actually make it feel like it rises, it falls, it has tension,
yes.
And then release.
Yeah.
Even in the context of hardcore, absolutely relentless metal. I mean,
oh, yeah.
But yet you definitely tapped on what I admire so much about what he did on that score is the production of it is so astounding. And it's so well mixed. You put it in headphones and you listen and you can hear so many layers of sound, you know, distant background and medium background and medium middle ground and then distant foreground and then foreground, where you just think he sculpted this must have taken forever because it's so meticulous.
Oh yeah.
And and I like what he did on the sequel, but I felt that the first one was truly something special. It's a score that you know, there's a lot of video game scores that I think can hold their place among the great video game scores of all time. You know, I would put Gary Shyman's Bioshock in that category. Jessica Curry's Everybody's Gone to the Rapture.
Right. It's very iconic.
The original Super Mario of Koji Kondo. You know, Nobuo Uematsu, Final Fantasy VII. You know, the scores that just are synonymous with video games themselves. I think Mix Doom 2016 deserves to be in that category. Nice. And it's a pretty kick-ass.
Yeah, it makes you feel like a real man, even if you're not.
Yeah, I remember. Actually, the funny thing was that the music, Rami Ismail's description of the music on Twitter, is what made me try the game. Because I was like, I played Doom as a kid, and it was, it was fun, but it's like, no, I'm not interested anymore. And Rami wrote a tweet that was something like, this game feels like it was, how did he phrase it? It was something like, the game is metal. It's like the music manifested as a video game, not the other way around. It's not a score describing the game. It's like he wrote this album and a game came out of it somehow. That was sort of his description, and it made me go, you know what? I should play that game. That's a pretty compelling way to describe it. And I went and played it and was blown away. I was like, wow, this is so fun. Like they did such a good job. And yeah, his score is half of that. In any case, so that's my album recommendation. I promise it, despite being a soundtrack nerd and composer of soundtracks, I will use the album recommendation aspect of this podcast to recommend non-soundtracks when they occur to me. But when the subject is hell, pretty hard to beat.
I mean, no, one. There are so many, though. There are so many options. But yes, I guess it's fresher in your head.
I guess that's true.
Okay, after talking a little bit about music and demons being smashed. Actually, we didn't, but I just had that in my mind while you were talking about that score.
Smashing demons.
Yes, smashing demons. We have Buddhism. Do you know anything about it?
I know I have read at one point or another, but I can't off the top of my head remember what the sort of general... I'm sure that any Buddhists who hear this will probably, no matter what you say, they'll disagree, because one of the things that seems to be interesting about Buddhism is how different the different, like, different people interpret it in such varied ways, and there are such different, like, groups within Buddhism that invariably different people, I mean, I guess all religions have this quality,
yeah, but. Well, I'm just basically just reading a concept that I found on the internet. Obviously, I don't know how accurate this is, but sure. It says in this version hell, souls are meant to work their way through multiple levels and mazes in order to atone for their sins, as well as learn lessons they can take into the next life. Some lore divides the afterworld into east and west sections, with chambers designated for all manner of ironic punishment. I feel it's very close, it's very similar to the Dante's Inferno. The worst part is really depends on what someone's been doing with their time on Earth. Each level of DU corresponds, I think that's a word for hell, corresponds to a different sin. So if someone has prone to gossip, they will have their tongue turned out. Arsonists are tied to pillars of burning copper, etc. There's a mountain made of knives that is reserved for anyone who slays for pleasure.
It's so interesting to me how my first instinct hearing that is hell for a gossiper having their tongue torn out doesn't feel like the right punishment. It feels like the gossiper needs to somehow feel the worst version of what it is to be gossiped about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But that said, so far of all of them, this is the clear winner because it's because it's the only one that is it's not eternal. It's a path. Hell is a way of, it's almost like prison. It's theoretically meant to make you realize the error of your ways so that eventually you'll be released and hopefully be like corrected.
I think you will find the next one more appealing, which is Judaism.
Well, like I said, my understanding is there essentially is no hell in Judaism.
For Judaism, Sheol is a shadow. Is a shadowy netherworld described as a pit where people go when they pass away, disconnected from God. The lifeless become shadows of themselves. Their book suggests that everyone ends up in Sheol, whether they're good or bad. The worst part, while there's no major demonic figure that reigns over Sheol, the worst part of this version of hell is the shadow that people become. There's no hope of a release instead. A soul can only hope to fade away until it forgets who it was in life.
Yeah.
And there's I have another version. It says, sometimes interpreted as separate from Sheol, the Jewish Gehenna is the closest equivalent to the fire and brimstone of the Christian hell that exists. Here, humans burn and the wicked are punished, but the sentence doesn't last forever. Souls are allowed to live Gehenna after 12 months. There's a catch though. No matter who you are, you're going to get out of the lake of fire after a calendar year. You'll be punished for everything you've done, and if you're good, your soul will ultimately ascend to heaven. But if you're evil and your soul isn't cleansed, it will be exterminated.
Right.
So I think that's the one that you meant.
Yeah, interesting. So your final existence is torture if you're evil, and then you just cease to be.
Exactly.
So it's like just, the last chapter of your book is a shit one.
I don't like that. Even if I'm good, I have to go through that. So, yeah, I don't think that's one for me.
Well, you know, the Old Testament, which is the foundation of Christianity and Islam and Judaism, all share in common the story of Adam and Eve and the notion of original sin. So it would make sense that I'm assuming that Gehenna is a fairly orthodox concept, because it's more modern Jews and more progressive Jews that tend to reject hell entirely. So it would be a more orthodox belief that would see Gehenna, which would therefore have a bigger embrace of original sin and say, of course you have to go through this because we're all sinners. We're born sinners. We're inescapably sinners. That would be the foundation, as I understand it.
Yeah.
I am an armchair theologian, as it were. I am fascinated by religion, and I've read a lot of books about particularly Christianity and its origins, and I love watching debates with atheists. But as anybody who is religious, who is listening to this and hasn't abandoned us, obviously, neither of us are experts, and we're driven by our curiosity for these things, not a desire to, you know, make fun of it per se, or like, I would never make fun of a believer for believing, even if I genuinely think they're wrong. I could be wrong. I am not convinced that I'm wrong.
Yeah, if you're wrong, you'll see.
That's theoretically
whenever
true.
You cross that line, you'll see.
Yeah. You know the part that's frustrating about that, just to mention, by the way, if I'm wrong, I'll know it. But if they're wrong, they'll never know it. Like, they'll just die and cease to be. And they'll never actually have gotten the validation of knowing they were right or wrong. And I've always found that a little frustrating. So what were you going to say?
I was going to go for the next one, which is one of the most iconic, you know, the ancient Greeks.
Hades.
Yes, Hades is the very known version of the ancient Greek underworld. Tartarus is much more hellish. In terms of distance, Tartarus is located further down the cosmic ladder than Hades. It was believed when someone passed into the underworld, their fate was decided by three judges who determined whether they spent eternity in Hades or Tartarus. The worst part is that there's nothing good happening in Tartarus. If you end up there, you've done something awful. It's where horrible offenders and monsters are sent after they expire. Even worse, anyone who fights with a god will also be sent to Tartarus, regardless of what they were fighting for.
Well, if you're Zagreus, you can fight through Tartarus and eventually fight Hades himself.
I didn't go that far.
Oh, you gotta.
Oh man, it's so hard.
I mean, yeah, not any soul can get out of there.
And I have a last one, which is Islam. Jahannam has been described differently in various discussions of the Quran, and in some instances is an actual beast that can be sent down to earth by God. It is mostly believed to be a whirling pit of fire situated under the bridge that all souls have to cross in order to enter heaven. The worst part is, for a Muslim to enter paradise, they must cross a bridge that's strung above a vortex of fire that is hungry for souls. It varies from sin to sin and person to person. It's up to God to decide how long someone is locked in Jahannam. I think that one is actually pretty cool. It sounds like a video game.
It also is, you know, Islam being by far the youngest of these religions, it feels the most modern. Like, the idea of we don't know what God will do with you is a more modern concept, whereas like older religions have a tendency to be like, oh, this is the personality of God. We understand God. And more modern religions go, how could I know?
Right.
You know, and it, so I didn't know that about, I don't, there's a lot I don't know about Islam other than its origins being so closely connected to Christianity and Judaism. And somehow I don't think I'd ever heard that description before. There's something interesting about the idea that all souls must cross this threshold and some won't make it.
Oh my God.
The visual image of the Pixar movie Soul.
I was picturing Shrek and Donkey crossing the bridge.
Yeah. So yeah, that's but it is striking that it's unknown what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, so we have 8 options, Austin. Which one would you like to go?
I think I stand by my earlier the Buddhist conception of hell is a thing you essentially earn your way out of eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
corrective.
You cleanse your soul. Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah, that is cool. Who knows? Who knows? This is a big question.
Well, billions of dead people might.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, it's funny how any subject, any religious imagery or thought always lends itself so beautifully to great art and poetry. There's something about the evocative imagery and the ideas, the notion of a soul, all those kinds of things. Like when you say, I watched this movie and it spoke directly to my soul. Like, I will say a thing like that.
Right.
But I don't believe in a soul. Like, to me, our mind is our brain, and our brain is a physical object. Like, I have a very materialist belief of the reality in that way. But yet, I can't deny that it always feels unsatisfying to speak in those terms compared with more religiously loaded language. And I've always thought that was interesting. Like, anytime you hear a composer or a band or whatever try to write like an atheist song, it always is lame. Whereas like a song about, you know, holding my soul back from the edge of hell or whatever is always more interesting.
I know, yeah. It's more romantic. I think different from you, I believe that there's something else after this. And I would love to think this is hell. Oh my God.
That life is hell?
Yeah, that this is the bad place, you know, to say some way.
Well, if this is the bad place, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I know.
Somehow better.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely don't think any description I've ever heard of heaven feels like it logically can exist.
I know. But maybe we can talk about it in another episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah, the unsatisfactory nature of atheistic art is something endlessly fascinating to me as an atheist. Like, which I separate, art inspired by like science and the cosmos is different. But I mean, when I hear songs that are like, just use logic, I'm like, that's so lame. Like, what kind of lyric is
that?
But I've heard songs like that they're trying to reclaim art from religion. But I'm like, I don't know that it can be done.
I get it.
Even Richard Dawkins says he loves to sing Christmas spiritual songs and things with his family. And I'm like, yeah. I totally get it.
Yeah. It has that spark. You know, it has that.
There's something. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hell, I think it's a beautiful place to portray.
Yes.
And I think there's so much to say about this. And I think we're going to end up talking about heaven as in some other time, because yes, it's so much.
And then
stuff,
purgatory.
And there, yes. but I'm so grateful for anybody who's listening, and for you, Austin, to take time off to do this. It's so fun always to learn new things. And
yeah, I hope it's interesting, and I hope people listen. I hope people recognize that it is two people who don't pretend to know everything at all.
Absolutely.
Who are
not.
Curious,
yeah.
And just talking.
Yeah, we're learning
every
together.
Now and again. Yeah, exactly. Every now and again, when topics like this come up on other podcasts I've done, there's always someone who will leave a comment that makes it seem like we're talking as if we're some authority figure.
Oh, no,
figure.
Not at all. I hope it's
and,
clear, yeah.
Yeah, and they always give us shit. Like,
oh, no.
You don't know what you're talking about. This was painful to listen to, and I hope
no,
that anybody that's still
gonna,
listening.
Because we have the best listeners, and they're not going to be they're not gonna be assholes. I know them.
Well, okay, I think you're right.
Thank you again, everyone, for listening this far and for joining us in another episode of Brooches and Keys. I'm Angela Bermudez.
And I'm Austin. Wintery.